for a Gopher Football Knowledge Bomb. This is the FBT Podcast with hosts MV and Bullet Boy.
Oh! That's pretty damn good! I like it! That's pretty good!
Drive stroke above, let's go.
Welcome back, everybody, to the FBT Podcast. This is your host, MV, and joining me on the podcast this week is a very special guest, former Gopher captain and offensive lineman, Derek Burns.
Thanks, Matt. Appreciate it. Nice intro.
Well, no, I definitely appreciate having you on. This is a great treat for me. You should, in case people are not aware of your illustrious Gopher history, why don't you go through the details? So you were, what, a three-year starter back in 1999?
Yeah, that was probably the first time I've heard illustrious with offensive linemen. Those usually aren't used in the same sentence, but I appreciate it. I was fortunate enough to start for 3 years under Glenn Mason back in 1999 through 2001. I went to high school in Eden Prairie, was recruited by the university, right next door, and had a good time. It was a great experience, learned a lot. And I just, you know, I'm happy for the exposure that the program is getting now with sites like yours and these podcasts. And I think we need more of it.
Absolutely. I try to fill a void of internet hacks that talk about the Gophers, since everybody else on the internet or every other program has their share of it. So I figured I've got to fill this void.
You know, I think you're doing a good job. Really, truthfully, I think there has been a void. You know, obviously the program has struggled and everybody knows that, but I do think the interest is still there. I don't think it's hurt the interest, you know, to a point that it's not worth covering or that nobody's interested. And I think, you know, with the stadium and some of the things that have happened, and obviously the new coaching staff, and I think people more than ever want to see this team win. They want a reason to get behind the team. And so I think you are filling a need and a want for more coverage and more exposure and, you know, just a reason for people to get behind the team.
Absolutely. Well, I thank you for the kind words. I know you're just pulling my leg because you're on a podcast with me and you have to say nice things, but let's move on and not talk about me and then talk about, you know, as you mentioned, the Jerry Kill era. Now, you are part from that 1999 team is probably one of the most heralded Gopher teams of the last 50 years. And they had, and you're the upset against Penn State at Happy Valley when they were number two in the country is still one of the lasting memories of the Glenn Mason era. So with that in mind, why don't you tell us from your perspective what you think about the newest era of Gopher football, considering you are a regime removed from the current power structure?
Sure, definitely. Well, thanks again for the kind words. We enjoyed our time there, my teammates and myself, and we were able to do some fun things, and it was nice to see the fans get excited. And I think we're seeing a lot of that same excitement. And I guess my observation of Coach Kill is I feel like there are a lot of similarities in coaching styles with Coach Mason. There's definitely differences too, but I think what he's come in, you know, the old adage is there are schemers and then there are basics guys. And I think Jerry Kill, no question, he's a back to the basics, a football coach, a fundamental guy. So he's done everything he's said so far, which is he's going to come in, he's going to work on the fundamentals and get that done right first. And then he'll worry about talent and putting things together and building from there. So in that respect, I think there's a lot of similarity with Glenn Mason. I think what you're seeing so far is exactly what I would have expected, which is a team with more discipline, less, you know, things like personal foul penalties, less penalties in general, guys in position, you know, things like that. There obviously are still issues, but from my perspective, I think he's come in with the right attitude. I don't think anybody planned for him to have the PR impact he's had. I think people were thinking, well, this guy can coach, but he's sure not going to be good, you know, at the microphone, and he's not going to resonate with the fans. I think he has, because I think his honest attitude has you know, caught a vibe with the people of Minnesota and the Midwest that follow the Gophers. I think he's a good fit for that part of it. So I think all in all, you know, good start. He's doing what he's promised that he would do, and he's mentioned that this is a long haul, and I think it is. But, you know, from my perspective, I like what I see so far.
Well, I absolutely agree with you that his personality and his brutal, almost honest to a fault personality is what has really won over the team. I think for so long during the last coach's tenure that people just weren't buying what he was saying at all. So they were hungry for a coach that didn't overpromise and underdeliver. They just wanted a coach who's going to be real with them. And yeah. if Jerry is anything, he is absolutely real 100% of the time. I mean, at the press conference today, he mentioned that he had 20 seizures in the last 6 days. I mean, with coaches, with modern college football coaches, most of them are so concerned about their image, and they don't want to take a PR hit that they would never admit something like that. They always want to downplay everything, but he downplays it by being completely honest.
Yeah, it's, you know, I can say, you know, being in the position I'm in, having listened to a lot of football coaches over the years at different levels, and as a fan too, I definitely look at things with a skeptical eye, you know, and you kind of go into it with the assumption that, okay, these guys are going to say one thing, and well, what do they really mean? And are they saying this for recruiting purposes? And are they not mentioning something for a reason? And why are they not mentioning it? I mean, honestly, I've not found one case yet where, you know, one instance yet where this guy hasn't just told the truth. And like you said, maybe in some situations where, you know, he could have skirted the issue or, you know, kind of avoided things. He's not. Maybe that's, you know, hurt him in some instances, nothing big. But he, I think, for better or for worse, is going to be honest. He's going to tell you exactly what he thinks. And, you know, for example, you know, he comes in and says, you know, after a few practices or workouts in the winter, you know, we've got a long way to go. We've got some speed issues. We've got some things to work on. And right away, people are thinking, okay, is he lowering expectations? Is he saying this for a reason? Is he trying to get the, you know, work a different angle? And I think looking back on it, he's calling it like he sees it. So
yeah, I think he did. And that's one of the things that I thought about over the last 3 weeks, when, you know, we noticed certain tendencies about the ball club, that and I just kept thinking, you know, has there been one thing going back 9 months that, with Jerry said, that hasn't been the truth? He said that they weren't a very physical ball club. They have had spurts. He said that they weren't very consistent. He said that they didn't know what they were needed to do, and they were learning, and that it would take time in order to get the type of program that he was going to run. You know, Marquise Gray breaks Sandy Stevens, you know, 60-year-old rushing record, but Kill for the last 9 months has been suggesting that what they're asking him to do is really difficult, and it's going to take him a long time. That he's not where he should be on the developmental track because he hasn't spent time at quarterback. So that's one of the things that I think is the most refreshing. It's different to hear a college coach who just tells it like tells it like it is and like he sees it, as you said. And frankly, I mean, from a coverage and a media standpoint, he's a home run, because he will say anything that's on his mind. He will say it. There's no need to, you know, coax an angle out of him or decipher what he's saying. What he says is what he means. And the other thing is, he's so darn funny that you have to pay attention to him, because he's going to say something hilarious every single day.
Yeah, and he, I know this has been talked about a lot, but with the health issues that he's had, and you know, as close as he's come to, you know, having to walk away from the game, or possibly, you know, being bedridden for X number of months or whatever, I think that's where his humor comes in. Is he sees this thing as, you know, you know, am I really going to take this, you know, to the point where I'm going to be worried about everything that comes out of my mouth and every word? And I think that's where his humor comes in, because he just tells it like it is and says, you know what, the consequences are what they are. And, you know, he laughs his way through some of that stuff, which is nice to see.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Moving on to a different subject here. You are, obviously, a former offensive lineman. I, being vertically challenged, am not an offensive lineman, but I am somewhat of an offensive lineman junkie in terms of blocking schemes and just overall strategy. So I would really love to pick your brain and have the listeners key the listeners in on a couple of different things related to offensive line schemes and terminology, and especially as it relates to the current Gopher scheme, because from my understanding, the blocking schemes that Matt Limegrover runs as an offensive line coach are very similar to the ones that Glenn Mason ran with Gordy Shaw during your tenure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. I'm not sure where you want me to start, but there are definitely similarities. They run, from what I'm able to tell, they run inside zone. They run a power. They like to run power. They run some pin and pull. Some of the backfield action is a little bit different. They do a little bit more fake handoffs. We were a little bit more of the single back, you know, we're going to run inside outside zone. It's a straight handoff thing, but there definitely are some similarities. And matter of fact, some plays are exactly the same. So I've been watching them close. So I'd be happy to give my opinion on any part of it.
Absolutely. All right. Well, I've got a couple of questions so far on pin and pull, because it's one of those things that I think fundamentally people understand inside zone versus outside zone, because, I mean, it's like any type of coverage. I mean, when you're talking about man-to-man versus zone, you're blocking an area versus a man. So correct. People fundamentally understand what an inside zone blocking scheme is, but they don't really understand what maybe power or pin and pull are. So maybe if you could, you know, kind of describe what all goes into pin and pull and power blocking.
Yeah, sure. Moshe, I'll start with just zone blocking. The offensive line is going to their first couple steps, and their motion is always towards the blocking. So they're blocking a gap. So for example, if it's a handoff right side, all of the offensive linemen on the snap of the ball are going to be blocking a gap to their right or two gaps removed to their right. So what if you put your eyes in the heads of the defense, what they're seeing is they're seeing motion on the snap of the ball go towards where the ball is going to be handed off. So on a inside zone to the right, the defense is going to flow to their left because that's where they're seeing motion. And the running back himself, it's up to him to read the cutbacks and go against the grain and look for he starts on a read at one hole and then goes back and looks at each gap until he finds a hole to hit. Yeah. So power blocking a power pin and pull as opposed to zone blocking is the linemen that are blocking down are going to actually on the snap of the ball step away from or down block away from the flow of the handoff. So if you put your eyes in the head of the linebacker, what he sees on the snap of the ball is one or two linemen stepping down and then the rest of the line in the back motion going to the right. So what you end up with is you're slowing down the read of the defense on the snap of the ball, which in football, the first couple steps can make the difference a lot of the time. So what you're trying to do is by mixing up the two is look for what the defense is reading and figure out whether zone or power or pin and pull, what is going to work in what situation. And a lot of times you start out running heavy and with one type of run, which then of course opens up the other type, because if they're cheating the zone, for example, they're going to be setting themselves up for a down block, or if they're playing too far upfield, they're going to be, you know, ripe for a kick out block and a power or be hooked for pin and pull. So
yeah, that's one of the other things I wanted to talk to you about too, is when you're running these different types of blocks, is there a sort of rhythm and flow to it from the offensive coordinator's perspective that, you know, because they're showing the defense a certain set of runs, then you're going to all of a sudden hit them up with a counter, or you're going to have the running back decide to cut it back if they're cheating to one side? I mean, you know, how exactly does that play into it?
Yeah, that is the case. That does flow into it. And what you look for as an offensive coordinator is you look for how they're, first of all, how they're coming out, lining up, what they're stacked against. And you start out with some running plays to see how they're going to play that. So if you start out, for example, with inside zone and to see how they're going to play that, you look at where they might be cheating over, where they might be stunting, what they might be playing to, and you look for how far, like things like how far upfield is the defensive line getting on the snap of the ball. You know, are they looking for penetration or are they playing more vertically? If they're getting upfield with penetration, you look for things like power, things like draw, screen, stuff like that, to take advantage or to calm down the upfield rush. If they're sitting back and they're playing overplaying gaps, you know, if they're overplaying motion, you know, you go back to an inside zone and the cutback should be there because guys are running too far vertically, which tends to open up backside cut lanes. So, you know, when you're looking at it on TV and you see the first couple series and a lot of times you always hear about plays are being scripted and that sounds like kind of an odd thing. You know, why would you script it? Aren't you calling for down and distance? Well, a lot of the reason you want to get those scripted plays in is because you're looking at how the defense is reacting to those specific plays. And you kind of have if the defense does A, we're going to come back with B scenarios set up.
Excellent. I don't know if you describe pin and pull a little bit, but that's if you could go into a little bit more detail about that. Isn't pin and pull, from my understanding, really requires a lot of the tight end. You need a really good blocking tight end to push upfield while the while the backside guard and center, you know, kind of do a sort of, you know, rotation of sorts where they take the place of where the tight end is supposed to be, and then the back itself is angling about 1 yard outside the shoulder of the tight end, and that's where they're aiming towards. So that it's essentially you're getting your linemen out in space, but their primary responsibility is to block the weak side and the strong side and the middle linebacker, allowing so the only player left, there's a one-on-one situation with the safety who has to come down to the alley. Or, you know, the corner who's supposed to force the play towards the backside pursuit.
Yeah, you've got a pretty good concept of it. It's you know, in a perfect world, you would want your down block from your tight end or your front side guys to be, you know, driving guys 7 yards off the line of scrimmage. You know, in Division I college football and the NFL, that's not the reality now. What you're looking is to just get a good cover up on the front side to contain those guys. And not only do you need a good blocking tight end, but you also need a pretty mobile center. Guards are usually they're at guard because they can move, so that's usually not an issue, but you usually need a center who can pull and get out there, which isn't easy to do. And what those guys look for is they get out and again, in a perfect situation, they are taking the front side first attack, so it'd be like the inside 7 or 8. And then you're correct, what you want to do is leave one guy, preferably a strong safety or a corner, for the running back. And the old saying is that's where the running back earns his scholarship. So the down linemen, they do their job blocking, and you ask the running back on any given play to beat at least one man. So if he can either break a tackle or shake one guy, he's done his job. You know, obviously the better running backs they're shaking, you know, two or three guys or breaking two or three tackles, but in an ideal situation, you want to set that up so they're able to beat one guy and hopefully get, you know, at least 6 or 7 yards downfield before backside pursuit comes.
Terrific. Just how important for an interior lineman, because you started off your career as a guard and then you moved to center to take over mm-hmm. for Ben Hamilton when he graduated, just mm-hmm. how important are these two physical attributes? Foot speed and hand strength.
Okay. Well, I'll tell you, foot speed, I would say probably above anything else, is what differentiates a guy who goes to UMD or a smaller college from a guy that's at, you know, a Division I college. And as you go up the ladder from there, you know, the higher Division I, there's the difference. Guys are going to be big, you know, from at all levels of college, at linemen, I should say, are going to be big. They're going to be strong for the most part. But foot speed, especially your first couple steps, getting out of your stance, are definitely what separates. And then you talk about getting up into the NFL, and what people don't realize watching on TV is just how fast every player is in the NFL that's on the field. I don't care if they're 300 pounds or you know, 180 pounds, they all can move. So critically important, especially if you're dealing with some of these, you know, anything that you're pulling or you're getting on the, you know, the second level linebacker on up, foot speed is important. And not only for obviously, you know, getting to your block quickly, but also maintaining balance. You know, you have to have good feet, quick feet. You know, when you're engaged with a defensive lineman, 285 pounds or 300 pound defensive lineman, it's about leverage and balance and being able to, as I said, sort of cover up those blocks, you know, and, you know, again, you'd like to be driving guys off the ball, but that's, you know, 1960s stuff. You know, today's age, you're looking to cover up guys and just keep them from making the tackle. As far as hand strength, as everybody knows now, the you know, you block with your hands. We used to say hairline and hands, which is, you know, like the forehead, you know, the upper part of the face mask and your hands. That's where you engage with guys. You don't typically, unless you're cut blocking, you don't shoulder block anymore. So hand strength is important for run blocking. That's where you're engaging. And then pass blocking, again, the rules today, you're taught to lock guys up inside, extend the arms, you know, inside the shoulders of the defender. If you get outside, you're going to be called for holding. If you pull guys down, you're going to be called for holding. But if you're locking up with guys in pass blocking inside, you're going to be fine. You're able to control them a little better. And like I said, run blocking, that's where you're engaging. You know, a lot of guys, you see a lot of guys injuring their thumbs, spraining thumbs, things like that. And the reason for that is not usually not getting stepped on or things like that. It's they're hitting guys and they're going for a chest and they get it caught in the face mask or, you know, on the collar of their shoulder pad, something like that. So both things very important. But I would say, you know, foot speed and quickness at the Division I level is probably takes priority.
Just how much technique can you actually teach a high school offensive lineman? From your experience, how much of a jump is that from high school to the BCS, you know, Big Ten college level?
It's a, you know, there's the physical part of it will come because, you know, you're going to spend countless hours in the off season. For every hour you spend, you know, or every 5 minutes you spend on the field during a game, you're going to spend, you know, I don't even 15 hours, probably 50 hours, maybe off the field working on your strength. So you're going to mature physically and you're going to get your strength, you know, that will come now. So the other part of it obviously is technique. And that's a huge part of it. I know for me personally, I mean, it was a huge jump. I was physically overmatched. You know, when I came in as a freshman, and the technique was completely different. Very few high schools, you see a few of them now starting to run zone techniques in high school, but for the most part, they're man blocking. They're running things like sweeps and traps. So the technique is totally different. Blocking a space or a gap is just a foreign concept. So it's important, and there's a lot of technique that goes into it. And you know, our coach has always said, you know, and I think this really, really helps relate to how the guys are doing now on this team this year, is there's kind of three stages with an offensive line. The first stage is knowing who to block. So what your assignment is, reading the defense, getting your calls on the line and figuring out who you're going to block or what gap you're going to block. The second part is technique. So how you're going to block them, what your technique is, what your keys are, what you're trying to do in order to be successful for your blocking assignment for that play. And then the third part is effort. And that's a one step after the other thing. So when you look at linemen that are inexperienced or that haven't had a lot of time to mature, they're not able to get to the technique part until they're sound and, you know, until they understand the who to block part. And that's, you know, you hear Coach Kill several times this year talking about, we need to scale things back. We need to cut back. And I know he's used it in reference to the quarterback and a few times, you know, just to keep him locked in. But that's also important for the linemen. You can't go in with a new system and throw out, you know, 20 running plays. I know when Glenn Mason came to Minnesota, the first spring ball he was there, they ran two running plays, and I don't even know if they threw a pass that whole spring that he was there. I'm not kidding. They ran inside and outside zone for 15 spring ball practices, and he knew the importance of, if we don't learn how to block these two plays, and we don't learn the who to block, how to block, and then work on effort, we're never going to get to the how to block and effort part of it. So I see that a little bit of that with this team this year, and I think Coach Kill has done the right thing, and I hope that he does continue to make sure that we're doing we're running a few plays or we're running a few techniques correctly before we start throwing other stuff in. I know you got to win football games, and I know you it's hard to do that, you know, running a limited number of plays, so you want to push past it, but it's important to get those, you know, those fundamentals and technique, you know, on the few plays that you have right first.
Absolutely. And I know that you mentioned Coach Limegrover and what Coach Kill are doing so far, especially with the offensive line. I know that Coach Limegrover has basically said that they only have three types of running blocks. And, you know, Ed Olson Jr. has come out and said, you know, in terms of what they're doing this season, it's way less complicated than what they ran in the past. And it, just in terms of everything that they have to learn and all their responsibilities. But you can kind of sense, even, I mean, Kill and Limegrover have been really brutally honest that they're not as happy with the offensive line play so far, that everything is just kind of, you know, it's not going the way that they want it to. Is that a problem? I mean, they specifically mentioned the three senior interior linemen. I mean, I know you don't have to throw anybody under the bus, but is this something that's, you know, kind of expected with a scheme transition? I mean, and is it something that's easily correctable or that we should expect out of, you know, the three seniors?
Well, you know, with any other position in football, you look at, whether the guys are what they're able to do with what's there. So you look at the talent that you're given and you judge based on that talent. You can't go in and say, you know, expect things out of a group that, you know, they can't meet. And so I think they're being realistic about that. But from where I've sat and from what I've looked at, I can see where they've been frustrated. And from what I've been able to tell, the defenses they faced, particularly the first two games, didn't see it as much the third game, but they did exactly what I would have done with a new, I shouldn't say new offensive line, but with a new scheme, which is they move guys on every snap. So if you have an offensive line that's learning, and I know they've been through a spring ball and through a 2 days camp, but you know, there's nothing like live competition in the game, and they're running defenses that you don't see in practice. And one way to attack that is by moving guys on the snap and trying to confuse and really clog things up in there. And I think both USC and New Mexico State did that. I think USC did it because they felt that, again, these guys might not be adjusted and might not know how to block these plays against different stunts and twists. And I think New Mexico State did it strictly because they were overmatched from a physical level. And what you do as a defensive line or defensive unit, if you're overmatched, is you run a spaghetti defense, which means on the snap, guys are just going all over the place. I mean, there's a rhyme and a reason to it. They're twisting and everybody has their gap at the end of the twist, but that's a technique that's used to you know, just try to confuse things and kind of muck things up. So they've struggled. I mean, from what I've been able to see, the offensive line has struggled to pick that up, but at the same time, that's no easy task, you know, against defenses that are doing that. So
is that something that you think was going to improve over the course of the season, that once they get more comfortable running the type of plays and the type of, you know, inside or, you know, pin and pull or power blocking, that you're going to see some improvement? And then a second question I had with this is just how important it is for a type of running back for these different types of plays. Like, I'll just throw it out there. It's my personal opinion. You know, I'm not an offensive lineman because I'm really short, but there's, it's just my opinion that there are certain running backs that are better at running through inside zone, because even if the hole isn't there, they will either power their way through it and fall forward, you know, through a really mm-hmm. small crease, or mm-hmm. they can make a cutback if something isn't there. Are either of those two things true?
Absolutely. Absolutely true. There are guys that definitely their running style is more suited to certain running plays without question. There are also times that you can run the same running play and it looks like a completely different play because of who's running it. I had the experience when I was there of running, having different backs run behind us and our line. And there were definitely differences in the way that plays developed. And, you know, I think you can go a little bit too far with these guys have to learn how to gel and they have to learn how to play together. And I think that can be overstated sometimes, but other times I do think there's something to it. This offensive line has to know, and they will get better because they'll see the flows of defenses. They'll see how downhill the linebackers come. They'll get used to looking at things like that. And at the same time, they'll get used to certain running backs, their tendency to hit which holes they hit, how fast they hit them, how quickly they strike the line of scrimmage. That's just kind of a flow, kind of a rhythm thing that that they'll get used to. So, in answer to your second question, I think when you have an offensive line that's struggled and maybe they're getting on the blocks they need to get onto, but they're not finishing them to the degree that they should, I think you're better off with a back that gets vertical quicker, that gets north and south quicker, and that can break tackles. If you're dealing with a more mature offensive line that's going to allow the running back to get to the second level untouched, then you're looking in general for a guy that's a little more shifty, that's got a little bit more breakaway speed, that has a better tendency or a better ability to shake a linebacker or get past the linebacker. So I don't think there's any question that not only are better running backs suited for certain plays, but I think there are running backs that work out better given the ability of your offensive line, or at least where they are in their, in their development.
So when Coach Mason said on Saturday after Donnell Kirkwood, basically shook a guy in the backfield and then sprung for another 10 yards, and then another play he trucked a safety, that be your own blocker. So that they're depending on the offensive line situation and how well they run certain plays, the best thing for a running back is to be his own blocker.
Be your own blocker is that's definitely a viable term. It's definitely something that that stands to reason. And I think what you're going to see as the season goes on and the Gophers get into Big Ten play, that's going to become even more important because the holes that you're seeing, at least that you saw at the Miami of Ohio game, the availability, the ability of the defenses to get to cover up holes, to get to their gap, is going to close. So your window or your running lanes, if you will, things like that are going to get smaller. And the running back's going to be another 2 yards closer when he makes contact, things like that. So be your own blocker becomes, the better the defense you're facing, the more important that is.
Well, that is definitely something that Gopher fans should understand and should appreciate the knowledge of, because I think, again, this is just my opinion, but a guy like Donnell Kirkwood, because he is such a low center of gravity, he runs so hard, and he's very slippery in his running style, not shifty, but slippery. He's so hard mm-hmm. to get a clean hit on. Mm-hmm. He's going to become even more important as the season goes along because of what you said. He has the ability to make the first guy miss, or that he can break a tackle with his hard running style. And, just from what we do well right now at the moment, I think he's better suited to do it versus, Duan Bennett, who really needs bigger holes to run through that he can explode. But at the same time, there's another underrated aspect of all this is, Bennett is the infinitely better pass blocker, and he's also mm-hmm. much more versatile out of the backfield as a receiver. So these are all things from a personnel standpoint that you have mm-hmm. to understand and know what your players are capable of.
Yeah, I agree. And I think, you know, from my perspective, one of the things Bennett struggled with is he's taken a little bit more time to read on the running plays. And frankly, if the blocking isn't going to be as clean or isn't going to be as good as you want it to be, he's going to be back making his reads, waiting. And then he's making cuts in the backfield, deep in the backfield. And he's hitting the line that much later. And the defense has that much more time to get downhill, to get to their gaps. And so I think that's something he struggled with, where you look at Kirkwood, he's getting the ball. He's making his read really quick. He's making usually one read and he's gone. You know, he's getting vertical and he's not, you know, he's hitting the hole faster in essence. And again, I think that's helped them because of where they are with the offensive line right now. The offensive line has struggled a little bit. Again, the blocks maybe aren't as clean. Guys are getting an arm on the ball carrier, maybe not getting a whole body there. And you know, you're taught as a running back, you got to run through arm tackles. If a guy's not getting a shoulder or you know, a helmet and wrapping up on you, your job is to run through arms. So I think he's done that so far.
All right. I have one last question as it pertains to pass blocking and the type of quarterback you have to block or you have to pass block for. I have a friend who is equally as big of an offensive line guru, not guru, but big offensive line junkie like myself. And he contends that as an offensive lineman, it is much easier to defend or to protect a pocket passer versus a mobile quarterback like Gray. So his statement or suggestion was with Max Shortell in the game, because he's not a threat to scramble as much as Gray, the offensive linemen have an easier time understanding where exactly they have to block versus Gray, who they don't know if he's going to scramble, so they have to defend much larger swaths of space. And I think I think just to add to that, Chris Bunders came out today in the press conference and said they're getting used to the fact that Gray is going to scramble a lot in passing situations, so they're getting more comfortable with the idea that they're going to have to defend in space. Is this true?
You know, I'm not sure that I would agree with that. I guess it really depends on what you define successful pass blocking. And I'll give you an example. If you're a tackle blocking on the edge, you're taught to block or to get down to it, where you're taught to keep your defender from getting is the drop back area. So if it's not a called rollout or a called draw or a called, you know, some sort of a break and go, you know, drop and go passing play, you're taught to block where the drop back area is. So if you go back as a tackle and you set into your drop and he gets upfield on you and the quarterback decides to scramble and your block, your defensive lineman breaks off and ends up making a tackle, that's not on the offensive lineman. If the quarterback's going to scramble, he's got to read that like a run block and read that like he's running, of course. And it's his job to avoid the defense. Now, there's all the other side of it is if the play has developed long enough or gone long enough where you know the quarterback is scrambling, then you turn your pass block into a run block. And that could be what Chris is referring to regarding, you know, how long they have to hold their blocks, where they're, you know, what Gray's tendencies are in terms of scrambling. Maybe they know, okay, he's going to go back and set for this long, and then he tends to take off, you know, at this angle in this part of the field. You certainly can learn that part of it. But, again, as an offensive lineman, you're taught on your pass block, on your sets and so forth to keep the man from the pocket, where the drop back pocket is, and to keep him from there for a certain period of time. So I will say the other sort of answer to that is, with a player like Gray, you may be calling more sprint out, roll out, bootleg, naked, things like that. And that's a different type of blocking. I mean, that's a different type of pass blocking altogether. So in theory, you could say, you know, okay, this line that we have or these two guys we have at tackle, they're a little better on roll out or sprint out than they are blocking in the pocket. Or maybe in this case, these guys are better, you know, they're better off just setting back and knowing where the pocket is and just straight drop back pass blockers. And maybe they're not quite as good on rollout, sprint out and bootleg. So, but I would, all in all, I would say, you know, it really depends on how you define a successful pass block.
That's all I needed to know. That's incredibly interesting stuff from the perspective of an offensive lineman. All right, I want to thank Derek Burns for coming on the program again to talk about offensive linemen, which I am utterly fascinated by. I think offensive line play is by far the most underrated but important aspect of a football program. I'm sure, obviously, you're biased to this, and you would agree.
You know, the cliche is it starts with the offensive line, and there's a cliche part of that people roll their eyes at. But really, if you look at a team, especially a team that's developing with a new system, the unique part of the offensive line is you can't go away from that. You can't cover that up. If you have a receiver group, for example, that's struggling, there are plays you can run. There are things you can do to try and mask that and to try and work away from that until that develops, you know. And you look at just, you know, in the backfield, again, there's other things. If you're struggling running the ball, well, you go to a short passing game, you go to some of the bubble screen stuff. There's things you can do to get around that. If your offensive line is struggling or growing, maybe we should refer to it as, it's hard to mask that. I mean, you can't say, well, we're going to throw in a series of plays that the blocking doesn't matter. You know, that it doesn't matter if we don't block this right, it's going to work. So there is something to, you know, it all starts up front. And I think that's, you know, I think at the end of the day, it's true.
I just thought of one last thing before I let you go. Sure. Do the splits, do the width of the splits between the offensive line matter depending on the style of offense you're running?
Yeah, definitely. And on the play, run from play to play, they also matter. And reason for that, obviously, is you're asking the defensive line and the linebackers to cover different areas. If you're running outside zone or an outside play, for example, and you tighten up your splits, that gives your running back better angles. He's able to get to the edge quicker. If you're running inside zone, you widen your splits. You're opening up the gap. You're widening the gap that the defenders have to cover, which on zone, it's all about gap offense versus gap defense. So you're spreading the field, giving better lanes, making it a little tougher for the defense.
Would it be a situation where an offensive line would disguise their gap width in order to kind of confuse the defense to maybe think, oh, well, to know a tendency, okay, that if they're bunching up this way, they're going to be running it to the outside versus, yep, you know, if they widen it, they're going to run it inside, so they kind of vary it up a little bit? Or is it something that remains consistent throughout the course of an offensive scheme?
No, I think what you want to do is you want to use splits to your advantage, but of course you don't want to do that to the degree that the defense can pick up tendencies and you know, and at that point you become predictable. So you can get, you know, when you get to that level, there's all kinds of fun stuff you could do where, you know, you've set, you know, wide splits on three different types of three different times of a certain type of play. The defense picks up on that. Next time you go to run a different type of play, use that same split set and hopefully throw off the defense. So, it's all a game. I mean, it's a chess match. You use those things to your advantage, and you know, there are plays in there where splits don't matter as much, screen passes, things like that, that you use those plays to throw off the defense. You go out with some, you know, stance where you're way back or way up in your stance, or big split, small split. You can do that on that play because it doesn't matter as much, and you hope to throw off the defense if they happen to be reading that key. So it's all part of the game, and those are some of the things that, until you, I don't want to say master, but until you have a handle on the basics and the technique of your base plays, you can't really get to that level yet where you start doing those things. But it's definitely something that's there for you. And you know, the next level beyond that is like an inside outside zone of plays that are complementary. You can make your first couple steps off the line like one type of play, again, in order to get the defense to overcommit, thinking, okay, here comes outside zone. They overrun the play, which opens up the backside cut. So it's all the maturation of the offensive line and the scheme and running a system. Those are things that they will pick up. You know, you've heard over and over again, Coach Gill's, you know, they've had the same system, the same coaching staff. There are benefits to that. I mean, those are some of the you know, when you get, you hear that and you think, okay, that sounds nice, but what does that mean? Those are some of the things that, you know, that's what it means. You know, those are some examples of how those things can, you know, that might not be something they can get to in the first year of running this offense, but, you know, in the second or third year, they might be able to do some of those things.
Well, that is incredibly, incredibly insightful. I want to thank Derek Burns for joining me on the FBT podcast today. We are definitely going to have you back on again to talk more Gopher football and maybe even some more offensive lines, you know, jargon, if you will.
Great. Great. I'd love to do it, Matt. If people are able to stay awake, you know, listening to offensive line blocking schemes, I'd love to do it again. I'd love to talk Gophers. I'd love to talk about the games, game recap, upcoming opponents, whatever. It's love what you're doing, and I'd love to join you again.
Absolutely. Thanks again, Derek.
Yep. Thanks, Matt.
State beat writer for the Fargo-Moorhead Inforum. Welcome to the program, Jeff.
Hey, Matt, how are you?
I'm doing fantastic. Thanks for being able to come on and talk the big Bison Gopher rubber match, if you will.
Yeah, well, you know, I guess if you go back to 07, it is a rubber match, but you know, it's a little different tone, I think, for this game, for the football team in general, in that in 06 and 07, they were going through a transition, and you know, that was the game, you know, of course. It was, you know. And actually, I go back to 06 and I covered it. Most people thought, okay, you're playing Minnesota. Why are you doing that? It's going to be 52 to nothing, you know. And I don't think people understood or realized that, you know, the good FCS teams, or 1AA, as you will, back then, were, you know, can compete okay with some of the lower tier, you know, teams in major college football. And I think Of anything we've learned between FCS and FBS, I think that would be it. Now, if you took NDSU against, you know, Florida State, it would be 52 to nothing or worse. But Gophers are rebuilding. They're going through a transition, obviously. Everybody knows that. And just because of that, I think this game could be kind of close like 06 and 07.
Right. And just from my perspective as a Gopher fan talking about this, the I've kind of gone through a sort of bit of catharsis when looking back to the North Dakota State games, because, you know, that initial game in 2006 was like the first descent into Tim, you know, into our, I would say, our divine comedy of non-conference hell. Because from North Dakota State in 2006 to the loss in 07, you know, we lost 3 out of 4 non-conference games in 2007 to non-BCS opponents.
Yep.
You know, 2008 really wasn't all that much better, even though we were 4-0. We barely beat Northern Illinois. We required a fourth-quarter comeback to beat them. We really sleptwalked against Montana State. 2009, we barely got by Air Force. And also in 2009, we just played an absolute stinker of a game against South Dakota State. Then you go into 2010, barely beat Middle Tennessee. We played horrible against South Dakota, who wasn't even a good FCS team. And no. And it capped off with a really terrible loss to Northern Illinois, which we were dominated on both sides of the ball by Jerry Kill's team. So, you know, going back, it all really stems from that North Dakota State game in 2006, where we basically, the armor completely wore off for Gopher fans, and that aura of Glenn Mason, where he just would stomp teams like this, and even prior to that, he I think we beat Temple 62-0 that year. And for North Dakota State to come in here and basically it required us to block punt or a field goal at the end in order to pull out the victory from, you know, the jaws of defeat, so if you will, it's made me really cycle back and think about, well, you know, that's really where it all started. That and that game in and of itself was probably the downfall, the final nail in the Glenn Mason coffin. But mm-hmm. Enough about the past. Let's talk about the current NDSU Bison team, starting with the offense. I know that from a high-level view, actually maybe even from a small-level view, that both the Bison offense and then the Gopher offense are fairly similar in terms of style and offensive scheme.
Yeah, you know, I was at the game last weekend against Miami, actually, just doing some stuff in a column. And if Gopher fans were at the 07 game, the Metrodome, and you're there Saturday, you're going to see the same offense. You're not going to see a lot of difference. They're still running the West Coast. They're still doing the power running game. They're still, you know, the West Coast offense is not going to sell a lot of razzle-dazzle tickets. It's pretty basic. Just, you know, mainly based on man versus man and that kind of matchup. So, you know, there's just not a lot of difference. The names have changed, of course, but and the quarterback in 07 was really good. I mean, that guy, Steve Walker, was phenomenal. And this guy's coming on, Brock Jensen. He's a sophomore. He's young still. So it's his second, you know, he was a part-time starter last year, got injured. So running backs are good. 1-2 punch, DJ McNorton. Sam Algeri, I think those are the strength of the team. I think up front, Gopher fans are going to wonder why Billy Turner is not in a maroon and gold uniform, because he should be. And, you know, and the line's always been a pretty stable thing with NDSU on offense.
Yeah, one thing I noticed when I was watching full game highlights of the Lafayette game versus the Bison from the first game of the season was the offensive line is very similar in schematic style to Gophers, in that they really play a lot of inside zone, power, and pin and pull, particularly that the offensive line, they have good size and they have good mobility to get out on some of those on those sweep runs to on the edge and pull. So it's going to be quite a task to take care of those linemen in space.
Yeah, and I think that's where Jerry's program is going to be. You're going to see a noticeable difference. You know, what do we do here in the upper Midwest? Well, you know, we grow big people. We are. We're just bigger people. And we have big linemen. Paul Kornick from Orono in Minnesota. He's 6'6", 310, and pretty athletic. You know, I think that's the first task for the Kill program is to, okay, let's identify the really good offensive linemen in this state, and then we got to keep them, and we got to keep them and prevent them from going to North Dakota State, South Dakota State, or Northern Iowa.
Right, and I think just from a task of defending the North Dakota State offensive line in this game, that it's going to be really important for the Gopher defensive linemen and linebackers to fight off cut blocks, because it's very reminiscent of the Glenn Mason era, in which the linemen are very active, but they're also very adept at cut blocking too. So it's going to be, you really have to stay on your feet and stay off the ground.
Yeah, and, you know, again, that's a lot of it comes down to experience. I'm not sure about the experience of the Gopher offensive line. Maybe you can help me there, but I know they're pretty decent. I thought they're okay.
Right. I mean, our offensive line has our offensive line coach and offensive coordinator Matt Limegrover says, we've got two pups on the outside. We have a redshirt freshman starting at right tackle in Jimmy Jerry, who runs about 6'6". He's 310 pounds, and he was a former Army All-American. Then on the opposite side is a redshirt sophomore, Ed Olson, who started 8 games last year. He runs about 6'6", you know, about 305 pounds or so. Both are really athletic, have really good feet, and they move really well, and they're also good run blockers. But at this point, they're a little bit still learning the passing pass blocking. And then our interior offensive line are all seniors. Which Chris Bunders has started every game for the last 2.5 seasons or so. He started out initially at a right guard and then moved over to left guard last year. And then Ryan Wynn started every game as a redshirt freshman back in 2008 before back injuries really took away his entire 2009 and most of 2010 season. And, you know, right guard Ryan Orton has mainly been a reserve lineman, utility lineman for most of his career, and he's finally stepping up into a starting role after he started a little bit back in his redshirt freshman year. But, yeah, other than them, other than those guys, they're relatively young all across the board. There's not a single player other than the three seniors and Eddie Olson who had any experience prior to this season. And then depth has really been an issue. I mean, they've been hit hard. They had Brooks Michael was a guy that had a lot of promise coming in, but he's had to take a medical redshirt because of concussions, and his career might be over. They booted a kid named Matt Egan from Wisconsin because he just couldn't get with the program.
Yeah.
But we have another offensive lineman who has concussion issues, and Josh Campion. He was expected to show a lot of promise this year. He's actually supposed to be a redshirt sophomore at this point because he was initially part of the 2009 class, but
his brother played at NDSU, actually.
Yeah, there is an NDSU connection there, but he had back issues, and he had grade issues that forced him to grayshirt and eventually not enroll in 2009. He ended up at Fork Union Military Academy, and then eventually made his way back into the Gopher program when Kill picked him up late. But yeah, we're not really deep at offensive line, just like we're not really deep at almost any position. There's some talent there, especially at the younger ranks. Ed Olson's brother Tommy is a phenomenal guard who they've already pulled the redshirt off of him, and for the life of me, I can't understand why he's not starting. They have really good incoming recruits, including a guy named Jonah Persig down at Blue Earth, Minnesota, who is about 6'9", almost 300 pounds, and he was recruited by a whole bunch of programs nationally, including the national champion Auburn Tigers, Ohio State. So
there's a key right there. I'll stop you there. Like I was saying, you got to win those battles, and you got to keep the big boys in the house.
Absolutely. And then they got another kid named Isaac Hayes, who's a guard center prospect that had offers from, you know, Virginia Tech and Oregon State. And it was really good that we were able to keep him home because he's going to be a really good interior lineman. But yeah, that's what gives me hope for the future. But in terms of this game, you know, if any one of the offensive linemen go down, unfortunately, they will have almost no experience. Yeah, we have kind of sidetracked to talking about Gophers more than Bison. But tell me a little bit more about the Bison running backs. One thing I noticed is that they are very good at making cutbacks when the line is flowing to one direction, and they seem to be able to get into green space quickly.
You know, ever since they always seem to find somebody, you know, and it started with a guy named Kyle Steffes in probably 05. He's a kid from Dickinson. You know, just found another gear when they went Division One, and then there's this fullback from West Fargo. Nobody really gave much thought, and his sophomore year, they decided to put him at running back. We're all going, yeah, right. You know, what's Tyler Roll going to do at running back?
Yeah, I have nightmares thinking about Tyler Roll, what he did at running back. So
yeah, school record 263 at the Dome in 07. Anyway, so he had a nice career, and they found a guy named Pat Bashal from St. Louis, and he signed with the Patriots but got cut. And now the latest guy is DJ McNorton, who came as a pretty highly touted running back from Houston. Didn't really see the depth chart because of those prior two guys, but has actually had a linebacker for a while and then moved back to running back and just sort of blossomed. I mean, he was, I think he's probably the top running back, or maybe not two or three, in the Missouri Valley Football Conference, and behind him is a kid from suburban Chicago named Sam Ogiri, who, you know, DJ was out 2 weeks ago with a sprained ankle, although if it was a Gopher game, I think he would have played. So he'll be back full strength. And so him and Sam are pretty decent. And, you know, in a name in the future, they got a guy from Totino Grace coming in next year who's a gray shirt, and John Crockett, All-State running back. So this program seems to find the running backs.
Right. And it just seems that from watching in film, that it's a combination of the NDSU line, you know, really ripping up big holes, but at the same time, the running backs themselves are really good at cutting back, you know, and running counters against the line. Very similar in a way to what Glenn Mason's great running backs of yore did. Now the wide receivers, I know Zach Vraw is going to be out for this game with a broken collarbone, but you've got another really good one
Warren Holloway.
Yeah, Warren Holloway, that's the name. Just tell us a little bit more about the wide receiver core, maybe even the tight ends a little bit, what we can expect out of them.
Yeah, Warren Holloway is a senior. He's another Houston kid who's he's had some bad knees over the last couple of years, but seems to be looking okay now. By far their most talented. I wouldn't call him a draft pick by any means. I mean, he's good, especially for the Missouri Valley, he's good. But if you throw him in the Big Ten, he's just probably another receiver. And after that, you know, it's pretty unproven. I mean, that is a key to this offense. Last year, the passing game was bordering on horrendous, and yet they still made the playoffs because their running game was so good. I mean, you had everybody and their mother, you know, in the box defending the run, and they were still running the ball. So if this offense ever developed a consistent passing game, it could be pretty potent, you know, as far as top-tier teams in 1AA. Tight end Matt Veldman, 6'7". Gophers looked at him, kid from Becker, Minnesota. Didn't offer, you know. And he's a senior now. He's their top target. Behind him is they've always had pretty good tight ends, too. Some guy always stepping up. Because the tight end is a big part of the West Coast offense. It's, you know, it makes for a nice, ideal little short target on, you know, different routes off the line of scrimmage. So, and the fullback is a pretty good receiving target, too, in this offense. Last time I saw the fullback run the ball in the West Coast was, you know, probably 1992. I mean, they just don't get the ball, ever.
Yeah, right. You know, it just seems that, like you said, that if the passing game could ever become a big component of this offense, that it would be a top, they could make a lot of noise in the FCS.
I think they could run for a national title. I could if they have, yeah.
Right, and it just seems from watching the one game, obviously I'm not much of an expert as you are, but just I got the sense that your quarterback Jensen was just really, you know, he's not the most mobile guy, but he's mobile enough to make, you know, to move around in the pocket and buy himself some time. He makes good, smart throws. You know, they don't ask him to throw a whole lot, but when they do, they're really big on the play action game set up by the strong running game, and that's where you throw the ball over the top to Holloway. So I mean, from what I've seen, it's good, smart passing offense, kind of like what we've installed up here in Minnesota. It's just one of the big questions that I have going into this game is the passing game going to be enough to exploit the Gophers' biggest weakness, which is giving up big plays through the air when your offense is really built towards the ground?
Yeah, great question. and that's one of the things I think they tried to work on in the offseason. They made no bones about it after last year. I'm putting words in the coaches' mouths, is we need to be more explosive. We need to be a little more athletic and make bigger plays. Well, you know, they did that the first two games, but then again, it was Lafayette and St. Francis. So, you can't say a yes, but you also can't take it against them either, because the fact is, you know, they did make some big plays in those games. So we'll see how that pans out over the course of the season. You know, this game, it's such a battle of turnovers, you know, especially in FCS, FBS game, where the longer the smaller level team hangs in there, you know, the more, it's the old cliche, the more, you know, the upset prone the big guy is. And so I don't think you're going to see NDSU's offense, you know, get real crazy with, 20-yard down routes or post routes that might be susceptible to interceptions. I think you're going to see a pretty basic attack.
Right. And to your point, I think one of the single biggest thing that happens when there's any really big upset is the supposedly more talented program just lets the other team kind of hang around a lot and thinks that they can, you know, dominate them by doing, you know, even the basic things just overpower them without actually, you know, doing something right. You know, well, I think one of the big things that happened back in the Mason era and then the subsequent losses to all of the FCS schools that we've had is, you know, Minnesota just tried to run the ball against smaller defensive lines. And that really doesn't work if you don't have a really effective running game like we haven't had for the last 4 years. And we really don't have that much great of a running game right now, except for Marquise Gray. So yeah. I think if it, you know, against New Mexico State, you know, 2 weeks ago, what happened was the team just got into these long periods where they were just really ineffective on offense. And New Mexico State was very explosive in the first half. They caught us off guard with, you know, 3 bit long passing touchdowns. And we just, the Gophers just didn't convert on any of their opportunities. And we had some really timely, costly turnovers. Like you said, turnovers are play a big factor on all of this. So the longer you can keep an underdog in it, especially very early in the game, and think that you can just overpower them with your bigger, your FBS or Big Ten level athleticism, it's a recipe for disaster. And I would have thought that after years of doing this, that we would eventually overcome it. But we haven't overcome it yet. I mean, and it might take, you know, a year or two before they get it through their head that, you know, we have to be able to just do the basics and play up to our abilities rather than say, oh, well, we should be able to stomp these guys.
Now, you got to remember, NDSU is 4-3 against FBS teams. I mean, they got to be the only, maybe Richmond or somebody, but they got to be the only FCS team to have a winning record against FBS teams in the last 6 years. You know, wins. I saw them beat Central Michigan 42-14 when Central Michigan is coming off a MAC title here. That might have been 07 too, actually. You know, they beat Ball State, and we talked about the Gophers, and they beat Kansas last year. So, and they physically, they've shown with their style, they can hang in with these teams.
Right, and I think that's the danger of playing against a North Dakota State team or any really high-level FCS team is that they are going to believe they're going to play harder against a Big Ten caliber team if just to prove that they can actually do it. Because a lot, the added emphasis is there for North Dakota State because almost half the kids are from Minnesota. They all wanted to play for the Gophers. I mean, it's not just the players on the team. There's a lot of Gopher fans up in the Fargo Moorhead area as well. A lot of Bison fans are also Gopher fans, but just not on this Saturday.
Yeah. And you know, I'll do that story every year, probably, as long as I'm covering this team and they play the Gopher. It's such a natural story, right? I mean, what a natural motivator. Oh, they overlooked me. Well, you know, objectively, there's probably a reason they got overlooked, because they, you know, as a recruit, they probably weren't good enough. Although I'm in this case, I will say, there's with Billy Turner, Marcus Williams, linebacker Grant Olson, and Zach Vrah, who's out, there's four players. I think, and some people in the Bison program will say this too, are pretty surprised or shocked that aren't with the Gopher program.
Right. Actually, getting to Marcus Williams, that's a good transition to start talking about the NDSU defense. Marcus Williams is a kid that's, what is he, on every FCS postseason preseason watch list as a potential All-American at cornerback?
Yeah, and how he got here is he was a receiver at Hopkins and more of an offensive player, but Craig Bull was talking to, I think, the basketball coach from Clemson, who told him that, you know, if Marcus Williams could shoot the jumper and if he could be a good outside shooter, I'd sign him now because athletically he's, you know, he's got everything else. And so Craig got to thinking, he goes, well, if this guy's good enough to guard people in the ACC in basketball, he'll probably be a pretty decent corner at the FCS level in football. And he was right. And that's, I think Marcus could get drafted. I really do. He's by far the best cornerback I've seen in this program, and he's only a sophomore. So, and he's probably arguably the best corner in the Missouri Valley. I mean, I think he's that good.
Yeah. Speaking of the Bison secondary, I think you've got a couple other guys there that vied for postseason honors last year, and there's some preseason watch list this year. Can you tell us a little bit more about them and how the secondary operates as a whole?
Yeah, it's a Tampa 2, you know, so it puts a little more emphasis on it, takes some pressure off the corners, actually, and with some safety help. But Danny Eves is a senior free safety, although his playing availability right now is somewhat in question. Heard he got hurt his knee in practice. I don't know anything about the extent of it, so that's something to keep an eye on as game time nears. The other safety is Colton Hegel from Wisconsin, small town Wisconsin, who hits like a truck. I've never seen a guy hit. Well, I saw Joe Mays hit pretty hard. He's a linebacker now, who's 0-7 against Gophers. He's starting middle linebacker for the Broncos now, but Hegel's a hitter. Cornerback on the other side's unproven. You know, they got a freshman from Omaha and they got a couple other guys. So that may be one area where the Gophers will, you know, try to pick on. I mean, I would go opposite Marcus, of course, if I'm a quarterback. It's nothing fancy. You know, it's the old Tampa 2.
That's a really interesting dynamic talking about Marcus Williams, who was basically he was a wide receiver who flipped over to cornerback at the college level because he didn't play. He played some football, but he didn't. I can't remember if he played a whole lot down at Hopkins. But that's an interesting, because he's going to be going against DeJon McKnight, who's almost sort of the exact same scenario, that he was basically a throw-in player from Dallas Skyline High School. He was primarily a basketball player, but he was incredibly athletic and had just incredible athleticism and strength for his size. And he eventually blossomed to one of the better players on our team just because of his athleticism.
Right. And, depth, I think, is going to play into this factor. I mean, we could probably transition to the linebackers as we're talking, because I think that's really about the Bison secondary is what I told you right there.
Right.
You know, they got some. I think this defense is deeper than it was in 07. And I think this team overall is deeper than it was in 07. The linebackers, you know, you got a bunch of guys. You're not going to get at the FCS level, you're not going to get the 6'2", 230-pound, you know, prototypical top-notch recruit. What you got is a bunch of guys who are 5'10", you know, and
yeah,
220, but play pretty well and run pretty well. You know, like Grant Olson's typical. He's a backup at middle or one of the other spots, but you'll see him playing a lot. God, he's listed at 5'11". He looks like he's 5'10 to me. He's listed at 220. He looks like he's about 210 to me. You know, Guy just knows how to play. I mean, he's just a player.
Right. And when looking at your entire front seven, it looks like it's almost like the NDSU defense shares the same philosophy as our defensive coordinator Tracy Clays and Jerry Kill, in that they will willingly sacrifice size for speed because they want fast defense. And from watching you guys against Lafayette, your front seven was particularly active and seemed to have really good speed, especially along the defensive line.
Yeah, defensive ends, I think, are the strength of defense with Coulter Boyer and Kyle Emanuel. Emanuel's a freshman who, you know, had opportunities to walk on at Nebraska, and I think in retrospect maybe they'd offer him because he's made that much of an impact here this short of time. Boyer's, you know, one of the top players in the conference, and you know, and then they got some depth there too. Now the big key is replacing a guy named Matt Grotzik, who was a senior last year from Argyle, Minnesota. He was the beast inside, and the guy I counted on there is Levon Perry, who at St. Agnes down there at one time was a quarterback. And now he's up to 6'3", 275 or so. So, you know, and that's always been one. The jury's still out. I mean, again, it's only been two games against two weaker opponents. So it'll be interesting to see how the Bison hang tough inside. And I'll add one more thing. We mentioned about the linebackers. I thought that was one of the biggest downfalls of the Brewster era is, you know, they kept looking at the stopwatch and all the measurables. And I think they forgot to ask one question. Can this guy play the game?
Yeah, well, you can almost say that ubiquitously at every position is what is a good football player versus what is a good athlete. I mean, I've had a number of conversations. I think you talked to Matt O'Connell from Gopher Illustrated today for a Behind Enemy Lines section. So everybody check that out if you're a Minnesota Rivals subscriber. We talk all the time about how Brewster was really good at identifying athletes, and he recruited a lot of players that initially that people were wondering, well, why is Brewster looking at this kid? And then he would blow up with offers from all across the country. But he was good at identifying athletes. He wasn't necessarily the best at getting football players, and his staff certainly wasn't very good at developing football talent with them. So, yeah, that's absolutely one of the biggest downfalls. I think that's what we're seeing right now in this transition year is we have – a lot of kids at key positions on the depth chart who just aren't necessarily the greatest football players, but they're pretty good. You know, they're really good athletes. But if you don't like, I mean, Kill will say it right away. If you don't line up properly, and if you don't mentally understand what you're going to do, you're not going to see the field, even if you're the most athletic guy out there.
Right. And I'm sure he's got him practicing a little harder too, doesn't he? I actually talked to Chuck Broyles from Pitt State today, and Kill was his assistant in the 90s. Actually, Jerry Kill was on the field in the first ever game at the Fargo Dome.
Yeah, he talked about it at the press conference yesterday.
So, I kind of took that angle a little bit, started with Chuck Broyles. Anyway, Chuck said, one thing that I guarantee you that Jerry will do at Minnesota is he will get them practicing harder.
Well, absolutely. The players have even admitted as such that they've never been worked like they had within their first spring practice sessions with Kill, and that the practice intensity and the speed and the pacing of all of it is way different. And even from a football fundamental standpoint, they really preach execution. They demand pristine execution across the board and understanding assignments, fundamentals of tackling and gap assignments. So, they're across the board. I mean, almost all the players have come out and said that, you know, we thought we knew what we needed to do back in the Bruce era, but we had no idea just how important it was to get everything right until Kill came along and basically preached it. I mean, and a lot of that comes from the fact that Kill came in to TC at Bank Stadium with the Northern Illinois squad and dominated him. I mean, that opened their eyes a little bit to say, hey, if this guy beat us, so we might as well listen to him.
Right. Yeah, do you know this is the fifth straight year that NDSU and their FBS opponent is playing a first-year coach?
Really?
Because you had Brewster in 07. I believe you had Iowa State in 08. You had Wyoming in a new coach after Joel Glenn in 09. And or maybe Iowa State and Wyoming were switched around. I think Iowa State was 09 with I can't remember now.
I know who you're talking about. Okay, anyway. Paul Rhodes. Yeah, Paul Rhodes, 2009.
Oh, yep. And then last year, Turner Gill at Kansas. Now this year, Jerry Kill at Minnesota. So if I were the Colorado State coach, I think I'd be a little nervous.
Absolutely. All right. Just from a total defensive perspective, so I've heard a lot, seen a lot talked about how the strength of obviously the strength of the offense is the running game, but what is the strength of the defense? Is it just that they are so fundamentally sound, play fast, and they're really good along the defensive line at getting pressure? Or is it just a total, you know, philosophy on defense to just always be around the ball and swarm?
Yeah, I think that's it. I mean, I couldn't pinpoint one strength other than the DNs. Like the DNs are real good. But yeah, basically the Tampa 2 is generally a bend but don't break sort of mentality. I don't think you're going to see a lot of man press coverage up on these receivers, especially Knight, unless maybe Williams could do it. I don't know. He's probably big enough.
Yeah. So one of the big question storylines that we've heard talked about the leading up to this game is how are the Bison going to handle a guy like Mark Weiss Gray? Because he's Gray right now is essentially our entire offense.
Yeah.
Because if he didn't have the ability to scramble and make things out of nothing with his feet and then really and run these design counters and just break off huge chunks of yards that, you know, sort of free up the defense from stacking eight men in the box, and then he made a couple of really good plays in the passing game that really hurt Miami of Ohio early. You know, we wouldn't have much of anything because our run blocking is just not strong enough to the point where Jerry Kill wants it, and we only have one back that's that really gets vertical in Donnell Kirkwood. So, I mean, stopping every team is going to want to key in on Mark Weiss Gray, but how do you see the Bison handling that challenge?
Well, I suppose more of a contained mentality. I think they're going to if you're going to beat us with your arm. You know, what's he completing 52% of his passes?
Yeah, around there.
And I don't know if does he get to his second or third checks very often?
No, he usually takes off after his first check.
Yeah, so I would say they try to make him get him out of his comfort zone, and his comfort zone is his. I mean, he's a phenomenal athlete, runner. Right? When he came into post game last weekend when I was there, what is he, 6'4"? Is he 240?
245 pounds. Yeah,
he's 245. I mean, that's just a big. That's a defensive end.
Yeah,
that's a defensive end in FCS under center. Is what it is. So I would say they, you know, instead of attacking so much and, you know, maybe contain them in the pocket and let them beat you with your arm. NDSU would never tell me their game plan, but if I were a Saturday morning quarterback geek sports writer coach here trying to think what they would do, I would say, okay, you know, this guy, if he can beat us with his arm, then so be it.
Yeah, I think that's a, strategy that a lot of teams have really have tried so far, especially in the first two games where
It worked and it didn't work. Yeah.
Right. Well, the first two games, USC and New Mexico State really just threw a kitchen sink at Gray in terms of offensive line. I talked to former Gopher offensive lineman and Captain Derek Burns for an earlier section of the podcast, and he said that the first two games, USC really threw the kid, really just blitzed him, and they did a lot of stunts, twists, and just went crazy with the defensive line because they figured with a new offensive line, new quarterback, that they could rattle them and get them out of their offense, and they were correct with that. And with New Mexico State, they didn't have any other option because they were physically overmatched. So they basically just he said he called it the spaghetti, you know, just like the kind of the can of worms defensive line, where they just do everything they can to confuse the line. Because they were, if they didn't, they would physically have just gotten beaten. I think portions of the game, they definitely got the Gopher offense out of their rhythm, and then, you know, mental mistakes played a part in that too.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if NDSU will get too crazy if they're just a pretty basic team. I don't think you're going to see a lot of crazy stuff. Well, they have been dabbling a little bit at the 3-4. I'd be interested to see how much they'd use that in this game.
Yeah, that would be an interesting wrinkle. I think a 3-4 may work and may not work against a bigger quarterback, and it gives those linebackers out space. One thing I think is important for obviously tackling a big quarterback is your tackling ability, making sure you get multiple defenders on him. So if you can get players in space that can de-lever from a block, then it'll help out tackling a big guy. Any final last thoughts on the game or how you see it playing out? I know you kind of touched on it briefly that you think it's going to come down to turnovers.
Yeah. And, you know, this has got to be the last year where we're talking that this game is going to be close, I would think. And if you're a Gopher fan, I would hope, because the reality of the situation is I'm going.
Well, you're cutting out a bit here.
Yeah. Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Okay. The reality situation is once you get a good Big Ten team, you know, it should be 42-10 every time.
Yeah.
So this will be the last year that you're going to see this game being this close as we're talking about it going into it. And again, it's got to come down to NDSU getting some sort of running game going, getting a few first downs with their passing attack and containing Gray. If they do that, I think they have an okay chance. At least they have a chance at winning, I think. And if the Gophers play a clean game, get a jump on them, you know, get up two touchdowns, I think advantage goes to them.
Right. I think that's a fairly standard formula for any Big Ten team or any team, FCS versus FBS.
I don't think NDSU has the ability to rally from deep down. You know, they're more of a grinded out offense. So that's why I think it's important that the Gophers come out strong and get a decent lead.
You don't see, as you said before, you don't see a September surprise here where kind of like with South Dakota where they just came out flinging the ball all over the place and the Gophers weren't expecting it?
Yeah, I don't. I've never seen it. I mean, I've been covering Craig Bull's teams for 9 years. I've yet to see it. So, that would floor me, no doubt.
All right. Well, I thank Jeff for coming on the podcast today and talking a little NDSU football, and best of luck to the Bison in the game.
All right. My pleasure, Matt. Nice talking to you.
All right. Thank you.